approach the lectern, we have a proposal that I would like if you would both approach. Because the cases are parallel in many respects, I thought it would be more efficient, unless there's an objection from either counsel, to have the cases proceed instead of having one case appellant, appellee, rebuttal in the second case. Simply have combine the argument so that we have appellant in both cases going first, government, and then rebuttal. Now, you will have your full time if you need it, so this should not deprive you of time. You've asked Mr. Benoff for 20 or 10 and 5 for opening and rebuttal. This would mean that you have 20 and 10 unless you want to alter that. And discretion would be 15 plus 15, so a total of 30 if you need it. If there's no objection, you can proceed on that basis.
No objection.
Okay, there's one other ministerial point. I think we don't have Mr. Benoff pages, and I think this is probably true at least most of the briefs we have, the ones I've checked anyway, pages 20 and 21 of your reply brief. Could you provide those pages to the...
I don't either.
Oh, don't you? Well, there's a certain logical gap there, so if you could just provide the pages at some point to the clerk's office as promptly as you can.
I apologize, Your Honor. What happened over today? Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it. What happened over today?
Oh, that's fine. Okay. Well, very well. Ms. Kirshner, is that arrangement acceptable?
Yes, Your Honor. And we do have a complete copy. I had gotten the missing pages from Mr. Banoff before today.
Okay.
So this is a complete copy if he wants to.
Well, I think why don't we just have Mr. Banoff submit the pages in any form that's convenient to the clerk's office. Very well. Argument first and in numbers 2007, 5011, and 5099. Mr.
Schwartzberg,
you understand the arrangement?
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm Alan Bennett. In Doe 5, you put federal employee overtime on life support. If you deny appellant's appeals in these cases, you will effectively pull the plug on overtime for federal employees under the Federal Employees Pay Act. The appeals demonstrate that employees cannot rely upon the good faith of their managers to issue written orders to work overtime when there's an ingrained expectation the employees will regularly work overtime on the strength of oral orders, and they will not be able to do their jobs well unless they work the required overtime. Overtime, which may be required by some document, an oral order, or an institutional custom that goes back decades. In the instant case, the appellant's claims cases, the appellant's claims arose under the pre-Doe case law.
Counsel, I don't actually disagree with anything you just said from a policy standpoint. I would think in important jobs, like prison officials, if the warden says, I need you to be here, they're going to comply, and it's imminently important that they do. And that would all take place orally, and it would ultimately deprive them of rightful payment. And if they were to deny the warden, I imagine there could even be some job jeopardy associated with doing that, or possible lack of advancement. I think all the policy reasons you asserted are perfectly reasonable. The problem is OPM issued a regulation, and we have a court interpreting that regulation is not unreasonable in light of the statute, which is our burden under Chevron. We have to give deference to the agency. And it seems like if you want to make these policy arguments, you actually have to make them to the agency in an attempt to get the reg changed, but that's really not something we can do on appeal.
I understand. The thrust of my argument today is going to show you how these documents that we've talked about in these briefs should be regarded as written orders, assuming that you apply Doe, assuming you give deference to the written order, to the regulation.
We can't not give deference to the regulation. We already did it. So stare decisis we're bound by. Even if I might not have gone that way in the first instance, I'm bound by it now. So
I understand Judge Bryson was on the decision, and we're all bound by that. That the point I want to bring across here, especially today, is this. The court below was unreasonable and unrealistic in viewing the documents, which we regard as causing the employees to work overtime. The employees were caused to work overtime for many reasons, and you just talked about one very important document, the program statement, the standards, which informs all Bureau employees that oral orders are as good and as important as written orders. That is the Bible for all of the employees of the Bureau of Prisons. If this document says that an oral order has the same weight as a written order, and you can be found insubordinate and disciplined for disobeying that oral order, then this document, this program statement, the standards, is a document which should guide your decision in all of these cases. The document should have guided the judge in the court below. It's a document that requires all of the employees to follow oral orders. When the oral order says you will work overtime and you fail to do it, you will be found insubordinate, you will be disciplined, and it makes no difference whether it's an oral order or a written order. That's a paramount document which I hope you'll consider right here.
Can you direct me in the appendix to exactly where that document is, the one you're referring to right now, the one that you said?
Yes.
In the case of oral orders, the same exact way as written orders.
In the Carlson case, we referred to it on pages 3 and 4.
But I want to know where the document is.
And in the Carlson appendix, you'll find it, Your Honor, pages 70, 71 of the appendix, and 74. The standards manual declares that employees are to obey the orders of their superiors at all times.
Can you show me though where it says what you said it said, which is where it says that oral orders are to be treated identically to written orders?
Because of the table of penalties. The table of penalties.
Just to what page?
74.
Yes, thank you. It doesn't distinguish between oral or written orders. It says failure or delay in carrying out orders, work assignments. There. Insubordination. It doesn't distinguish between written or oral orders. Any order.
Oh, but nowhere in this, so I'm confused, only because I thought I understood it, and I might have misunderstood it, but I thought I understood you to say that this document expressly says oral orders are treated identically to written orders, and that's not...
No, it doesn't distinguish between the two.
You're inferring.
Yeah, yes.
It's not that the document says that, but you're inferring right. It from a penalty that says if you don't carry out orders, you
correct, Your Honor. It says orders. It doesn't say written order. It says orders. Any order. Any order. This is a very important document that governs all the employees in these cases.
If an employee was ordered to do something that he's not required to do, could the government really take one of these actions against him? And what I mean by this is, suppose he was ordered to work for 5 hours in the middle of the night when he was purely a daytime employee, and he declined to do so for whatever reason, do you really think they could then take action against him under this provision when it's not in his job description, he has clearly articulated hours?
One factual mistake you made there. The job descriptions, all the job descriptions in these cases refer to all the manuals.
I'm getting hypothetical. I'm not talking about these exact people with these exact circumstances. I'm saying that I don't think that what you pointed to, if what someone was asked to do was outside the scope of their job, I don't see how the government could pursue penalties against them for failing to obey it.
I think you can very safely assume that the Bureau of Prisons, a quasi-military organization, will take action against an employee who fails to follow any order, oral or written. And if you're given an order, you've got two choices. You either have to obey it, or if you don't obey it, you can grieve it later on, but you have to obey it. That's the standing rule. You have to obey it. Unless it's an illegal order, you have to follow it. It wouldn't be an illegal order. It would be an order to work overtime. And I assume it would be within the job description. The job description requires an employee to follow the orders. The job descriptions always say that. You must follow the orders of your superiors. So if you didn't follow the order, you would see that case here on appeal from the MSPB. The MSPB would affirm a removal action against that employee for failing to follow an oral order to work overtime.
But could they order them to work overtime? I mean, suppose the employee was unable to. Suppose it was a single parent with kids at home and had, no one to watch them. I mean, there are lots of circumstances I can imagine. So Suppose that there was an order to work overtime and the employee was incapable of performing. Is that the kind of order for which they could really be reprimanded or removed? Unable to work more than what they ever agreed to work. It just seems like a stretch.
Okay. You're adding some facts there that would distinguish it, and sure, that you'll find wardens and associate wardens and captains will say, okay, if you can't come in, we'll find somebody else to do it. Yes. But if you don't have a good excuse, you're going to have to do it. And if you're required to come in and get your keys to the control center, if you're required to do tasks along the way, if the Bureau requires you to talk to inmates along the way, all of these things are required. And some of them, there may not be a direct order saying, you must do this.
I'm sympathetic. Why do they have the 30-minute period of overlap in the morning and not a similar period in the afternoon? Do you have any idea?
I
didn't know if this came out below in the course of your interaction with this case.
Well, I can say this. I can tell you why there are overlaps. The overlaps developed out of the first Bureau of Prisons case we brought back in 83, that went from 83 to 96 before it settled. As a result of that case, which had the very same claims for preliminary and post-preliminary overtime, they issued Operations Memorandum 214-95. And in that case, in that order, told them they have to start counting the time of employees from the time they come into the control center, when they start to pick up keys or equipment at that point, they will be regarded as on time at that point. As a result of that, the order also required them to start overlapping shifts to minimize or eliminate overtime. So you'll see...
Why haven't you pursued an action then for their failure to do that in the afternoon shift? You're saying that they were ordered to have some sort of overlap, but my understanding from the facts of these cases, Mr. Shea and others, is that there's an overlap period in the morning shift when the people are coming off the night shift and coming on in the morning. There's 30 minutes of overlap, but there's no similar overlap at the end of the day when the day shift goes off and the night shift comes on. Am I misunderstanding those facts, or do I?
No, you're correct. I don't think that either the individuals have standing to do that. Now, the union representing my clients are non-union. My clients are outside the bargaining unit. But the union may have an argument to raise, well, you ought to overlap these to minimize the overtime. But my clients, who are managers and supervisors, don't have any standing to tell the Bureau. You need to follow Operations Memorandum 214-95 differently. But it's a fact that you've got these shifts which are butting up against each other, and there is no overlap there on two of the shifts. And the result is, if you want to do your job well, you're going to have to come in early or you stay late. If you don't do those things, especially for lieutenants with post orders, it's very, very good. These post orders plainly require work before the shift begins. If you follow them, you read those things. It has a block of text.
Is there anything that prevents any employee from requesting overtime when they've been ordered to work outside their normal work hours? Preventing them from requesting approval in writing.
There is no rule, Your Honor, but there is an inertia, there is a discouragement. It's very, very plain in the Bureau that you follow the flow here, and the Bureau disdains what they call minutemen. People who show up just at the minute when they're supposed to show up, who leave at the minute they're supposed to leave. And the custom, the tradition is you don't question these things. Overtime is not something that you're going to get. You're expected to work overtime without overtime pay, and you're just going to do it. You can ask for it, and that's why people do it, but there is a body of an agency telling you, don't even think about it. So yes, there are cases where people have asked for overtime, and they can get it sometimes. But as I said, the thrust is the entire agency is telling people, don't think about it. And wardens have told people, we've quoted from them here, wardens have told employees, don't even think about it. It's just things with the turf. You're a manager, you just work the overtime, don't ask for it. Just put in the hours. And so you have a lot of very good, devoted public servants right here, protecting us and in institutions to guard prisoners, inmates, people who are suspected of crimes, who have been convicted of crimes, and they are very dedicated people who are going to follow the traditions. You don't question. You do it. You've got, I mentioned the standards of conduct, which is paramount here. We have other documents, the training documents that reinforce the expectation that the employees need to work overtime, their correctional...
But counsel, the court ultimately found, even with regard to the post-preliminary time that the lieutenants worked, that it was de minimis.
Okay.
It was less than 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, we disagree, of course, for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons was the judge was slicing and dicing the time. He wasn't considering it consecutively. He was isolating different parts of it. If you consider all of the time that the employees, say Lieutenant Shea, spent, which is post-preliminary, it amounts to more than 10 minutes a day. If you need to count the time, for example...
But didn't he testify himself at some point that it took 10 to 15 minutes before he
yes.
left, basically?
Yes, he did.
And, but that included walk time when he's already technically off the job.
No, he's not the job. No, he's not. He's within the institution. He hasn't even gotten to the control center yet. We're talking about the time it takes from closing up shop in the lieutenant's office. And that requires him to finish up the lieutenant's log. Part of that's been worked on during the day, but he can't leave until he finishes the lieutenant's log. And then his replacement comes on. He has to give the keys and radio to his replacement. And he needs to tell the replacement what's gone on. Information is very, very important in the institutions. If you don't know what's going on...
I understand, but all that is before the walking out time.
Yes. Yeah,
and that's all encapsulated within the 10 to 15 minutes.
Yes.
And then the walk time is subtracted out of the 10 to 15 minutes.
You can't do that.
Why is that?
Because it's part and parcel of the same work. It's all consecutive. This is not portal-to-portal time. He's within the institution. He's on duty. He's doing
the standard's
things.
Standard's not within the institution, right? Because my assistant leaves his desk, and really, when he leaves his desk, he's got to walk to the parking lot. Traffic might take him a while. You need to turn right out of the building. You don't get counted for all that time, obviously.
No.
So explain to me why that walk time ought to be included. Because normally, walk time leaving your desk to your car doesn't count.
No.
So that's not what you're saying. I'm sure.
I'm saying that since Baylor, and for generations, it's been held that the time you spend, which is integral to the work, and walking is part of the job right here because he's still on the job. He's still required to do things. He's still required to talk to inmates. He can't leave until he passes by the control center and he leaves keys there or radios or batteries. They're what are called 24-hour keys. But the 24-hour keys may enable you just simply to retrieve keys out of the control center. So you can't walk out of the institution with those things. That's very secure. So you are on duty. You're doing things. And then there are counts. There are inmate counts. The post orders refer to the inmate counts. They're counts. And those counts may start around 4 o'clock or so, but if you don't have a clear count, you can't leave. And you may get a clear count until like 4:15 or 4:20. A clear count means verbally, all of the posts have reported to the control center that all of the inmates are in their places and the right number of people are there. God forbid, they said, and I'm paraphrasing one of the witnesses, God forbid you should leave the institution and they found that somebody wasn't there. You'd be toast. So Lieutenant Shea isn't finished doing his work until after he goes to the control center and says, waves to those guys and says, I'm going, or he turns in his keys or his equipment, and then he goes at that point.
Now, what we're talking about now, of course, is the part of the Shea case that was tried, actually,
yes.
by the court, supposed to decide on summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in order to understand exactly what you dispute about the findings made after the trial by the trial court, say, sliced and diced, can you tell me exactly which elements of the trial court's analysis at the time claimed by Mr. Shea, but disregarded by the court, should not have been disregarded?
Okay, well, I was trying to do that.
Yeah, but we're sort of talking, we've got a count here, we've got walking here. I just want to be very sure what... I think I know what the trial court did. I want to be very sure I understand everything you think that the trial court got wrong.
Okay. But what the trial court should have counted was all of the time Lieutenant Shea spent starting from the time that it's now 4 o'clock, but he's still finishing up his logs. Sometimes there are reports that he's going to fill out incident reports. That may keep him sometimes. But even if he didn't have to fill out incident reports, he must finish the log. Then his replacement comes on. He has to give keys and a radio to the replacement. He needs to brief the replacement on what's going on. They explain information is vital. If you don't know what's going on before, you're not going to do a very good job on the shift.
But that's an element that the trial judge did credit. Just didn't make credit with as much time.
Right.
But nonetheless said that that's time which is credited to Mr. Shea. So you're not in any dispute over the question of credit. You just dispute the
amount of time. Yes.
But I'm looking for what are the elements that the trial judge disregarded altogether that you think should have been included.
Okay. To the extent that he didn't count the walking time we're talking about right here, the time it takes to leave...
3 minutes and 21 seconds that he took out. That's what he took out. He said 3 minutes and 21 seconds subtracted from 15, subtracted from 10.
Okay. And you got there. So this time that you get to spend in leaving the lieutenant's office after you finish briefing your replacement, and then you may be talking to inmates or other employees along the way. You go through Sally Court, you go into the control center there, and you can't leave until there's been a good verbal count.
We have a Supreme Court case, an IBP case, and it says that walk time to locker rooms where you would be removing safety gear you were required to wear during your job, safety gear that you can't take out to the car with you, that walking into the locker room to take all that safety gear off and store it is not considered work time. That's not part of the principal activity for which the employee operates. So I guess I'm thinking by analogy, could you explain to me why this case might be different from that
one? I interpreted IBP differently to say that when it's part and parcel of the main job that someone is hired for, you should count that as work performed. In this case right here, we had a change in the practice. Up to a certain point during the pendency of these claims right here, employees were, in fact, getting all of their keys and their batteries and their radios at the control center. During the pendency of these cases, they started changing the policy at FCI Otisville, which is where Lieutenant Shea worked. At that point, they started changing so that the incoming lieutenant would change keys and radio, change those with the outgoing lieutenant. That was in order to take away the time from the control center. The control center has what they call a key line. The key line was called for a reason. There's a line there. If you go there during rush hour, whether it's in the morning or the afternoon, when there's rush hour, it's going to take you a while to go through the key line. There might be two people ahead of you or 15 people ahead of you. That takes time. That's the kind of time which should be counted. The operations memorandum 214.95 expressly counts that time. It seems to count that time, it should count that time, because that is time you're spending on the job, and that memorandum makes it clear to the Bureau of Prisons that now we're going to count your time. 95-1 is that we will now count your time from the time you are in the key line. So from that point on, the employee should be, the time should be counted, especially because up until a certain point, around 2004 or 2005, the employees did have to get their radios and their keys at the control center. They couldn't go to their duty post without those things. If you needed to have the keys to open up secure doors, you needed to have a radio for security purposes and safety purposes. You didn't have that radio.
Well, the trial judge found that the key exchange, radios, and so forth, 5 minutes. You dispute that, but that was at the in the Shea trial.
We think you minimized the time, yeah.
Okay. But that was after having heard witnesses from both sides and crediting the testimony by the defendant's witnesses.
Yes.
So there's 5 minutes. There's I think in the Shea case, there's what, a 1.5 minute walk that the court found? I believe that's right.
Okay.
So The extra time beyond that 6.5 minutes that you say that the court disregarded is exactly what? I just want to make sure that I know where and how much extra time you're counting.
Okay. I can't give the exact number of minutes. Sorry. I have to go back. We submitted to the court below an outline which identified that the separate amount of time, and perhaps on rebuttal I can find that for you in the appendix, but we had a chart where we told the exact number of minutes in each one of those things there.
Counsel, can I move you over to something a little different, which is one of the arguments that you made in Shea, I believe it's unique to Mr. Tucker from Shea, if I remember the names right. One of the arguments you made in Shea related to the receiving of comp time in lieu of overtime payment.
Yes.
Are you following me?
Yes.
Okay. And it wasn't cited in the briefs, and I realized that was because we briefed it before we issued the case, but we issued yet another Doe case. You have the case of the Dodos. You know, you have Jane Doe, and then we have another case that came out just in January. In fact, by Judge Bryson, and I was on the panel, so it didn't escape my observation. But nonetheless, in that case, we explained that in comp time, you accept a one-to-one, when you elect to make that choice, you accept a one-to-one, and you give up the other half an hour, and that's your choice to make, but you make it, and then you give it up, and that's the end of it. So I assume at some point, hopefully, you've come across this case in preparation for oral argument, and I'm hoping that you'll tell me in light of that you recognize we're bound now by stare decisis with regard to our own decision on this exact issue.
But the issue is that you should not make that retroactive. At the time that the overtime occurred here, there were some instances where the employees were given the option. In some cases, there was no option. They would just simply say, we'll give you comp time, and that's it.
I don't believe that our case actually says that giving an option is required, but I may have given you that impression by the way I care.
But what I was saying is that the facts of the BOP cases here, the Carlson and Shea cases, and the other cases we've handled, is that there were times where management said, we will give you the option, but most of the time, there was no option. Management said, you're getting comp time. So you fill out this form here. I'm giving you the form. Fill out the form, you get the comp time. And so you get hour for hour, and you don't get the extra 0.5 for the hours you work overtime. That was what happened.
So is there evidence in the record that they were, because, I'm sorry, my recollection was that they were given an option, that the way it was briefed was that they were given an option of collecting comp time or overtime, and that for example, in Mr. Shea's case, there were 7 lieutenant's meetings that he attended outside of his normal work schedule. And my understanding was that of all 7 instances, he was given an option. Now, if I'm misremembering or misunderstanding, I'd love it if you point me in the record, because maybe this is a distinction that ought to be drawn in our precedent, and possibly our new Doe case allows for such. But I didn't find any evidence, any suggestion that he wasn't given an option. In fact, I thought I found the exact opposite. So if you encounter it, maybe before rebuttal, you could let me know.
I'll do that.
But apart from that, the one question I have for you is with regard to Mr. Shea and the 7 lieutenants' meetings. I understand that he had post orders that required him to attend, required all lieutenants to attend. Those were in writing. Am I understanding right that the court below held that those still weren't written orders meeting the standard?
Yeah, and they were cumulatively, and I want to emphasize that whenever you look up in these documents, please view them cumulatively, because in the real world, the managers and employees view them all cumulatively. It's the law of the shop. And cumulatively, you've got a lot of documents which require them to attend these meetings. You have institution supplements in each institution, and they state attendance meetings will be held at a certain time. The department meetings will be held at a certain time. And there are combined attendance meetings and department meetings at certain times each month. Those are stated in this institution supplement that goes out to all the employees.
Let me interrupt you, because I definitely understand all of your arguments about the various documents on this point, but what I wanted to get at was, so you have a written order that says they must attend. And by the way, that was enough for me. You didn't have to keep going.
Okay.
Then you have that much. And then he did attend. Now, granted, he didn't attend all of them. The court sort of took into account all these extraneous things, which I thought was interesting. But those were the same seven for which he did receive comp time, right? That's the crucial fact for me. The court may not have effectively treated these as entitled to overtime, but he did, in fact, get comp time for those seven.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
You're into your rebuttal time. Would you like to say?
Yes, please. I would just like to say that for the reason we say in the briefs and today, we asked the court to reverse the court below and proceed with further proceedings below. Thank you.
Mr.
Kershaw.
Thank you,
May it please the court. The trial court correctly applied this court's decisions in the overtime regulation from OPM at 5 CFR 550.11C.
Ms. Kushner, Judge Rubin, in his conclusion, and one of the interviews, which pointed out that the Doe case, and its extension in this case, does open up the prospect of abuse. And I think Judge Morris' question beyond outlining the nature of the abuse, it's fairly obvious what can happen is that there can be pressure through oral directives never put into writing on employees to work, in effect, off the clock, a practice that's employed in some private settings. What's the remedy of an employee under those circumstances where the employee is told, yes, you have an 8-hour shift, but you're expected to be here for a minute and a half or three quarters of an hour?
An employee presented with that situation does have the protection that's provided in Bureau of Prison Guidance, which is in this, it would be in both appendices, but I'm citing to the Carlson appendices at page 52. And this is a directive on attendance and leave, and it states that the chief executive officer or their designee must approve in advance the granting of overtime and compensatory time.
Okay.
So the chief executive officer would be your warden or a expressly designated official by the warden. So absent having that, the employee, absent an order coming from the warden or someone that the warden has expressly given the authority to, then the employee would not have to follow that order.
Okay, so the warden or the warden's designee gives an oral order saying the warden says be here 30 minutes early. What's the employee's remedy?
In that case, the employee, he either does what the warden says or he doesn't. Consequences would follow.
Right, and if he doesn't, presumably he ends up in the MSPB, as Mr. Banoff said.
Depending on circumstances, that could very well be. If there's an emergency situation, I am sure.
Well, let's assume it's not emergent. Let's assume, I mean, I'm trying to see if there is any remedy for someone who is basically told over the long term, without regard to emergencies or exigencies at the moment, over the long term, you're actually going to be working 45 hours a week, not 40 hours a week. And we want you here early and we want you to stay late. What's the remedy? What, if anything, is the remedy for somebody that's confronted with that kind of oral directive?
He can request overtime,
right,
for his services.
Right, which he's entitled to. It's according to the government's submission, as I understand
it. Under the regulations, he would not be absent a written order or approval, he would not be.
So he can request something he doesn't have a right to. What can he do by way of remedy to make sure that he isn't directed, given a direction which is enforceable, to work overtime for you?
Well, and his choice is either to perform the work or not to perform the work. But I think the the system here does depend on the good faith of government employees. And there was extensive testimony in the record, both at the trial and in the depositions that were taken that are part of the record, that the Bureau of Prisons does compensate employees when circumstances do require that overtime.
Okay, counsel, then why in the world do they institute a policy of 30 minutes of overlap in the morning shift? Obviously, they have decided they needed it, but they don't have a commensurate policy in the afternoon. So why is that? So you're telling us we should rely on the good faith, but it seems to me that good faith is obviously not being undertaken in this case.
Your immediate question was as to the overlap. The overlap was from 7:30 a.m. to 8 o'clock a.m. And this is the overlap between the two operations lieutenants.
So if it's necessary in the morning, why isn't it necessary in the afternoon? There's no difference, as far as I can tell, from the record in terms of what they must do at a transition time. A transition from morning doesn't undertake anything much more significant, does it? Am I missing something evidentiary?
I think what you're missing is that it did not arise from a necessity of having two people working at the same time. It came about because of the lunch hour break. The only people that had the lunch hour break that were operations lieutenants was the day shift. They worked 8.5 hours and got a 30-minute lunch break. Therefore, in order to have 8 hours, they worked from 7:30 a.m. to 4 o'clock p.m. Now, what I would also point out to you is that in FCIO is filled. When the schedules were changed by Captain White, he arranged that there would be only a 5 minute over, at least a 5 minute overlap between the ships, the operations attendants. And that was one thing that Judge Bukin pointed to when he made his finding as to the amount of overtime work that was necessary by the operations attendants. He pointed to the changes in schedule by the captain, which left only 5 minutes of overlap, as opposed to the half an hour of overlap that you're pointing to. I'm not sure I've answered all of your questions.
Go ahead.
Okay.
To follow up on Judge Bryson's question, Mr. Manoff suggested earlier that there was indeed sort of a culture there of overtime. There was an expectation of overtime, that they frowned upon the so-called Minutemen. And that, according to his argument, that overtime was expected regularly, and it was very much the situation where there was a little bit of an abuse, where the government expected the overtime, and overtime was not going to be compensated because it was not in writing. But is it your position that, in fact, the evidence that has been adduced in these cases refutes that, because there isn't, in fact, any evidence that there was overtime expected under these various oral orders?
All of those contentions by the plaintiffs were refuted on the summary judgment papers. The court did not find it necessary to make factual findings when it resolved the summary judgment papers. But we put into evidence, factual evidence, from the wardens and other witnesses, including the captains, who testified in depositions, and I think they also testified at trial, that it was their policy that they would compensate people when overtime work was necessary, that the individuals had to bring it to their attention, preferably before the overtime was needed to be performed. And depending upon the circumstances, they would make a decision. And there was testimony from the captains, and also at Otisville, testimony from an associate warden, Joe Wilner, which is in the record, where he said that the employee would have to come to the supervisor with the task, inform the supervisor as to the task, and the supervisor would make a decision. Does this really have to be performed today, or can this wait for tomorrow? If it can wait for tomorrow, it doesn't have to be done today, and we will not approve you for the overtime. We will do it tomorrow. So there was ample testimony in the record as to the process that had to be gone through where the employee brings the overtime work to the attention of the supervisor, and the supervisor then makes a decision. And that there is not, in fact, a culture of forcing employees to perform overtime work.
Well, but Judge Rubin himself, in both cases, concluded that there was, at least to this extent, a culture of overtime, which is to say that the post orders, he held, did require some overtime. Now, he ultimately held that it was de minimis, but he certainly, it seems to me, a fair reading of his opinions, is that he's saying there is a systemic requirement of some additional time beyond the shift time. You'd agree with that?
What I would agree with is that only for the operations lieutenant post order, mm-hmm. because there were post orders for all of these.
Which is Shea and Tucker, at least.
Which is, let me just do it this way. For Mr. Shea, it's the operations lieutenant post order.
Right.
Only that post order required the overtime. And the scope of the overtime that was required was only the exchange of information and the exchange of the keys and the radio
right.
between the two lieutenants.
Right.
All the other activities that Mr. Shea contended that he performed either before or after his shift were not required in the post orders. And that is explicitly what Judge Working found.
Right.
Now, as to the other lieutenant,
Tucker.
Right. Tucker was he had different jobs. Different assignments.
He's at Springfield, is that right?
He was at Springfield, yes. And what he did, he was a AM activities lieutenant or a PM activities lieutenant. And what Judge Brueggen found as to those assignments, they overlapped only once, only one time a day at 2:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
There were not three activities lieutenants, just two of them. They overlapped at 2:30 p.m. And so there was only the requirement for overtime for the AM activities lieutenant because his post order, AM activities lieutenant, his post order said, pass on keys and radio and information to your relief. So the AM activities lieutenant would be having to work overtime at 2:30 p.m. Okay. So in only those two circumstances did Judge Brueggen find that there was overtime required in writing by post orders.
But with respect to Tucker, at least, I mean, I think, I don't remember the exact amount of time in the Shea case that was determined that it was less than 10 minutes. Judge Brueggen found, but Judge Brueggen did find that sometimes, it concluded, based on some judgment papers of Tucker, which wasn't tried, if I understand the record correctly, concluded that there was somewhere between 6.5 and 11.5 minutes of overtime. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right?
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And that, I wanted to ask, since 10 minutes seems to be kind of the tripwire here for de minimis, both in the case law and the way that Judge Brueggen generally approached the problem, why do you think that the 11.5 minutes was not enough to trigger a finding of a non-de minimis overtime?
As Judge Brueggen found, Mr. Tucker had a range of overtime.
That's right.
It ranged from 6.5 minutes some of the time, and then some of the time, 11.5, as
right.
he estimated it. It is not de minimis because first of all, it is de minimis, first of all, because the rule is it must be more than 10 minutes, as Judge Brueggen found. It has to exceed 10 minutes. Now, you're asking about the 11.5,
right.
the day on which it's 11.5. Well, as Judge Brueggen pointed out, that's not every day. It's just an occasional day.
Well,
some
we don't really
days.
Know that, do we? I mean, that's the problem, is Tucker was not tried. And so Mr. Tucker, if I recall the evidence, said it ranged, his time ranged, and then he gave, I think, 10 to 15 minutes, I believe. And then Judge Brueggen subtracted out 3 minutes and 21 seconds, or whatever it was, from the walk, and came up with 11.5 to 6.5. So we don't know whether the 11.5 was 4 days a week or 1 day a month, right?
Well,
is there
that's
anything
correct.
More
you
help in the record for us
well,
than that?
What does help is that Mr. Tucker testified that he worked both AM activities lieutenant and PM activities lieutenant. And I believe in the record there's actually a chart that shows how often he worked which position, which I'll try to find the page for shortly. But so he, the only position where he was ordered to work overtime was the AM activities lieutenant position. So that's the only one you're dealing with.
Right.
He's not working that every day. Sometimes he works PM, sometimes he works AM. And then, as Judge Brookie pointed out in his findings, you also have to consider the administrative difficulty of measuring this overtime. And in this case, it only occurs at the end of the shift. It only occurs part of the time. And also, it's of the nature of the activity that when people are exchanging these keys and radio and information, they're also, it's the change of shift, they're engaging in personal conversation. You have to exclude that personal conversation when you try to measure the amount of time. So the judge pointed to the difficulty in measuring and monitoring this overtime at the change of shift at 2:30 p.m. And he pointed out that it would vary each day, that there would be personal conversation that would have to be excluded, and obviously you'd have to have somebody else there observing, taking down, and trying to measure and exclude this personal conversation in order to come up with the amount of overtime each day. And it was because of the administrative difficulty, in addition to the varied time, that it was not every day, that the court concluded that it was de minimis in nature.
Counsel, the court below concluded with regard to today that the post orders that required all lieutenants to attend the monthly meetings somehow didn't qualify under the OPM reg as written orders, and then referred to a lot of other circumstantial type evidence, like non-attendance by some lieutenants at the meetings. You know what I'm referring to now? Are you with me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. How can they not meet the OPM?
The reason they don't meet the OPM reg was, as this court stated in Doe, the order to work overtime has to be explicit and express. And in the Doe case itself, the Department of Justice attorneys contended that express or explicit orders were not required. It was enough if it was just an indirect order.
But if you're ordered to attend a monthly meeting, why isn't that an express order?
The language in the post order was all lieutenants are required to attend the monthly lieutenants' meetings. The language is not sufficient because it does not direct that they have to attend them on overtime, on their day off.
It says all lieutenants are required to attend the monthly lieutenant meeting. It doesn't say lieutenants who happen to be working that day. It doesn't say lieutenants who are on shift. It says all lieutenants.
Yes, but I think, as the judge pointed out, these post orders are for people who are working the shift. They're not for someone who's homesick. They're not for someone.
Oh, it's not true, though. There's certainly evidence that people who were not working attended these meetings. Just like there was evidence that people who weren't working didn't attend on occasion, there's certainly at least evidence that Mr. Shea, on seven separate occasions that he was able to document, attended the meetings as required, even though he wasn't on duty. Why would he attend if he didn't believe himself to be required to attend?
Because, in fact, there was no requirement that they attend on overtime, on their day off or outside of their shift. And as the court pointed
they
to
got
the...
Everyone got the emails, right? I mean, there were also emails, in addition to the post orders, that were sent to everyone reminding them of when the meeting was and to attend. So
that's not what the emails say. The emails are just bare-bone email that goes out, and it has the date and time of the meeting. It doesn't tell anyone at all to show up for that meeting. And those emails are all on the record. But as the judge pointed out, at Otisville, there was a consistent and routine practice of the lieutenants not attending these meetings outside of their shift and on their day off. And Mr. Shea himself...
Here's what bothers me about this. OPM has enacted a regulation that says if you've gotten writing something you're required to do during non-shift hours, basically that's, you know, you paid overtime, but it's only if it's in writing. And we come along and we're very strictly and stringently adhere to that as reasonable. And so now we've got somebody who's got something in writing, but you're saying look beyond the writing to the circumstantial evidence to claim that they're not entitled to overtime. You know what? Why don't I look beyond the writing in all cases? Why don't I look beyond the writing and look at oral orders? People are given oral orders all the time to do certain things. But yet, I would, as a judge, if you would have me do, follow the OPM reg and say, well, yeah, you're really getting the shaft. I'm sorry. You're being treated unfairly. You were orally ordered to do this, but I can only make the award if it's in writing. I'm not allowed to rewrite those regulations. But you want me to rewrite them when it is in writing and look outside the written record. I don't think the government can have it both ways, and it's frustrating to me.
What this court required in Doe is that the writing itself be explicit and express. It's not enough.
Does that mean
that
it must say you must work overtime? Does that mean the writing has to be explicit and express that it has to use the word overtime?
It doesn't have to use the word overtime, but it has to tell you to do something outside of your normal working
hours. All lieutenants are required to attend monthly meetings. There is evidence in the record that lots of people who were not on shift, but who were lieutenants, effectively attended these meetings. Obviously, they believed their attendance was required. Why is that not enough? It's written, all lieutenants are required to attend monthly meetings.
It's
so
not.
Who had the ability to be precise here? The employee? No. The person who wrote the most orders. These are orders.
These are directions for people who are on duty.
You want
these
them to follow orders, right?
These, of course we want them to follow orders, but they know that these are the orders for them when they are on duty. These are not orders for them when they are on leave, when they are...
You say they know it, then why did Mr. Shea show up at all these meetings? He obviously didn't know it, so it's not so clear from the orders as you would like me to believe, because the lieutenants, obviously many of them, didn't know it because they still showed up.
What the evidence in the record was that they were encouraged to come even though they were not required, and that they were told if they came that they would be compensated. And that's in the affidavits of the captains that are in the Shea record. People were encouraged to come.
So I just want to make sure, because maybe this is important. So the captains, there is actual evidence that the captains told them they were not required to attend?
Yes, and what they told them, not in writing. They told them that they were encouraged.
But doesn't the OPM write that all that matters is what's in writing?
But more than that, the writing has to be explicit and express. You have to have an explicit and express order to work overtime. There's nothing that tells these lieutenants that they had to attend lieutenant meetings outside of their normal working hours. These directives, these post orders, were
so
the directives for people.
To be explicit, you would have liked it to have said, all lieutenants are required to attend monthly meetings even if you are not working.
That would be one way. You could also, there's a number of ways you could have written it. You could have said, outside of your normal shift hours.
Let me see if I understand the way this works. You may have already covered this, but I'm a little confused. Lieutenants, well, in particular, Lieutenant Shea, they started with Lieutenant Shea. If I understand, when he attended one of these meetings that did not occur during one of his shifts, he got comp time, is that right? But he didn't get overtime?
Hey. He could have gotten the overtime, but he was given comp time.
Well, that's the point I wanted to explore. You say he chose the comp time, but had the option to get overtime pay?
That's
or
correct.
Was given comp time, but not given the option of overtime pay?
He had the option, and he was given comp time. There are forms that have to be filled out and signed by the employee. And in this case, Mr. Shea filled out those forms, checked off, put the C for comp time, and was given comp time.
But he would have, one of the things that I'm a little confused about here in the record is that there's some evidence that at least, what was it, something for everybody above GS-10, I think the GS level was, comp time was available, but not overtime. Is that right? Am I misremembering that?
No, you're remembering correctly, but that applies only to Mr. Carlson. Because of Mr. Carlson's GS level. That
right,
particular
Shea is 11, right?
Yes, I believe that's right.
So wouldn't that mean that Shea would be only entitled to comp time?
No. The reason it does not is because the statute uses the GS-10 level, but says it's the agency's decision. And then you have to look at the agency reg.
Okay.
And the agency reg, in this case, is not as stringent as the statute.
So you're saying the agency reg gave Mr. Shea the right to choose between the two, right?
The agency reg did not apply to Mr. Shea. It applied to Mr. Paulson.
Well,
so Mr. Shea had the ability to choose.
Okay. In other words, the reg was what would have denied somebody the right to choose. And that didn't apply to Shea. So Shea had the choice and he chose. Okay. Now, was that true of all of the lieutenants that were not above whatever it was, 12, that when they attended these meetings at Otisville, for example, is there evidence that they were all entitled to overtime if the meeting occurred outside of their ordinary work period?
All the lieutenants could have chosen comp time or overtime.
Okay. And there's evidence of that. Because the only evidence that I saw that Judge Booty recited was the evidence vis-a-vis Mr. Shea.
Well, there are affidavits from the captains in the record. The way the case came about is Mr. Shea came in contending that these were his claims and this is what he wanted.
Right.
And in response, the government responded. So we don't have allegations from other lieutenants as to what they're
saying. I'm just wondering whether there's evidence that this was the practice generally, as opposed to some
from the
peculiarity with respect to Mr. Shea's situation.
No, from the captains in the Shea record, there's affidavits in the record, in the summary judgment record, from the captains that they had the choice. And then secondly, to resolve that issue, the court also looked at the amount of compensation, because the question really is, was he compensated properly for his overtime? And the court found that, as Judge Moore pointed out, that he was given the proper rate of compensation. He was given hour for hour, which is in fact what is provided for the overtime work when someone chooses to receive comp time. And then I would just point out that the regulation 5 CFR 550.112A1, which provides that an employee shall be compensated for every minute of regular overtime work, that regulation is not applicable to Mr. Shea's situation. It applies only where the overtime is scheduled in advance of the work week, and there was no evidence that that was the case for him. I'm not sure where to put my last 3 minutes.
Well, you weren't obliged to use them all.
Well, the court also had questions as to the IBP case. That case impacts on two aspects of the work of the employees. It impacts on the key line. And as to the key line contention that the employee should get extra compensation for key line, what we're pointing out is, first of all, there was no written directive directing employees to wait in key line for any amount of time prior to the start of the shift. They were on time as long as they were in the key line at the start of the shift. And then secondly, that amount of key line time, whatever amount of time that they're waiting prior to the shift, it would not be integral and indispensable under the IBP case. And similarly, time spent walking after giving up the radio and the keys is not indispensable and integral to the work of the lieutenant, as Judge Rubin found. I would also like to just correct some statement that my opposing counsel made. At FCI Otisville, during all the time that Mr. Shea was working there, when he worked as an operations lieutenant, what he did prior to the change in March of 2005 is he came as an operational lieutenant, he came up to that control center, he gave him a chip, he got the keys and radio, and then he went on. He gave them the chip as an operations lieutenant. He received the chip of the other operations lieutenant, took that to the other operations lieutenant, and got the keys and radio. And we have the citations to Mr. Shea's testimony in the brief. So the keys and radio for operations lieutenants, they're always on somebody. They're on one of those three operations lieutenants. Those keys and radio are never in the control center.
Thank you. You have a couple of minutes.
I'll try first to deal with a couple of the points that has more raised. If you want to see how Lieutenant Shave left at his exit time, you will look at the appendix, pages 186 to, like that, 163 to 185. And in particular, if you look at 186 to 187, it explains how he spent his time and how he was leaving it at 410, 415. You want to remember, of course, that when he has preliminary time in those days, you need to add both those times together so that you don't just look at 10 minutes, you look at the entire overtime period for each day. We had a chart, and I can't find the chart that we used below, but the
186, did you say? That's
what appendix 186 to 187 in particular. But if you read 163 to 185 before that point, you get an idea of what he was saying as far as the time he was spending there. And then the different charts that the governor put in at the Shea appendix pages 1948 through 1954, and it also that I can't find our chart, but it. But maybe this is our chart too. I can't remember right now, it's been a long time. But we broke down the times that were spent, so it was 10 minutes, 10 minutes a day. Judge Brugink correctly looked at IBP to include the time that you spend in dealing with the keys and the radios there. You asked.
Well, if he included the time for keys and the radio, why did he exclude the 3 minutes and 21 seconds? Because you're saying the 3 minutes and 21 seconds is the walk to the control room time, and that is involved in the exchange.
It's a mistake. It gets included. It's part and parcel of the activities. In the IBP case.
You're not thinking correctly.
Correct. In the IBP case, there were two types of walk time. In one situation, the Supreme Court said you don't include it, but the walk time that the Supreme Court did not include was more portal-to-portal type of walking time. But the type of walking time the Supreme Court did include in IBP is the same kind of walking time here, where he's walking from the duty post, and he's still on duty. He can't leave until he finishes everything, and it takes him time, 10 to 15 minutes.
After the control room.
It's correct. After a certain time,
he's turning in a chip.
He didn't have to turn in the equipment. He turned in a chip. Yeah. So I'm very impressed with the point there that he was doing work. Let me just bring a couple of things up.
Let me make sure we're on the same page here. I'm looking at page 29 of the opinion in the Carlson case in the back. Where Judge Brugink was dealing with the 3 minutes and 21 seconds. And he's talking about that as by the time of a walk, the 3 minutes and 21 seconds, Mr. Tucker had already relinquished his equipment, his duties to his replacement, and his activity completed. That doesn't seem to square with what I understood you just to be saying.
Correct. He's not completed with his job until he either goes to the control center to turn in things if he needs to, or he acknowledges, he tells them he's leaving, so that they're aware.
But it says by then, that is to say, before the walk, he had already, as I understand the opinion, he had already relinquished his equipment. Are you saying that's just wrong?
No. He had relinquished the equipment as at that point.
Before the walk?
Yes, and he had briefed.
Right away.
Go ahead.
No, no, you're about to answer.
No, he did brief his replacement before that point. But his job was not ended then. The principal duties weren't ended then. He didn't end those until he is leaving. He has to walk from there. He can't just go instantaneously be at the lieutenant's office and the parking lot at the same time.
Okay, but I think, aren't you now saying that even though he's given up his radio, he's given up his chin, he's given up the keys, and he's heading to the parking lot, that's still billable time, so to speak?
Absolutely. It's all billable. He's still in the building. He's still in the building there. Not about parking lot time. And this, let me just make something clear here. There are two chits involved here. Make it very clear. At Otisville, when there's an accountability chit. So when anybody comes in, they go through a foyer, they go through a salad floor, there's an accountability chit that shows you are there on the job. Now, we are not declaring that you should hold the lieutenant chase time began at that point. It's an argument. But we're not making the argument. No, you know, he is putting that chip there for the benefit of the government to let them know he's there, and they know he's there. In case of an emergency, they know he's there. And then he walks from there to the control center. We're not counting that time either. Nor are we asking to count the time going up the hill from the main road to the prison. They're required to be vigilant to anything unusual happening along that mountainous path there. We're not asking for that. All we're saying is from the time that he passes by the control center, from that point on, whether he needs to turn something in or pick something up, the control center is an easy place where the government can regulate the overtime. It's predictable. They can predict the overtime here, that they can count the overtime here, they can count the time from when someone comes to the control center, whether they need to pick up something at the control center, a chip or a radio or keys, or just simply to tell the control center officers, I am here.
Okay.
I didn't ask one question, which is, if I just, one thing. If you refer to page 954, Your Honor, where Shea says, I wanted overtime, we were told we could not get overtime, that has to do with the meetings. That's page 954 of the Shea appendix. Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.